I'm Julie Burstein, in for Leonard Lopate on this hot summer afternoon. Over the last several decades, doctors and researchers have developed technologies that have allowed us to visualize aspects of how our brains work in ways that we hadn't been able to do before, and have led to the development of a wide range of fascinating treatment strategies, from electrical stimulation to neurofeedback. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about how the brain works and touch on some of the most interesting treatments for everything from depression to epilepsy to attention deficit disorder. I'm joined today by Dr. Sarah Lizanby. She's professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Division of Brain Stimulation and Therapeutic Modulation in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University and the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Sarah, you must run out of breath when you have to give your full title.
Well, that's why I keep my business cards handy.
And Dr. Lizanby is known internationally for her groundbreaking work with transcranial magnetic stimulation. And I'm also joined by phone by Dr. M. Barry Sturman. He's professor emeritus with the Department of Neurobiology and Biobehavioral Psychiatry at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Dr. Sturman, welcome.
Well, pleased to be here.
And Dr. Sturman is internationally known as a pioneer in the development of neurofeedback. Now, Dr. Lizanby, as we do with Please Explain, we love to start at the beginning, or as far back as we can go. And so I wanted to ask you first a few questions about how does the brain receive and transmit information?
So that's a really great question. And I would start out by saying that decades worth of neuroscience research have really focused on just exactly that question. But if we want to break it down to some of the basics, it's useful just to fill in some background that, as you know, the brain is composed of a number of different types of cells, including neurons, nerve cells, and also glial cells that surround and support them. And the neurons are connected into distributed networks. And we believe that the activity in these distributed networks subserves various brain functions, like processing visual and auditory information, or generating and understanding language and memory and so on. And within that network, the connections between the neurons are called synapses, and that's where the chemical message is released. These are called neurotransmitters, and you may be familiar with some of these, like serotonin, mm-hmm. norepinephrine, or dopamine. And that chemical message in the synapse is then converted into an electrical message, which is ion flux into the cell. And that ion flux generates an action potential, which is actually an electrical current. And that electrical current propagates down the axon till it reaches the next neuron in the chain within that network, and another chemical message is released, and so on. So when you think about it, neural transmission is both a chemical and an electrical event. Indeed, our treatments for brain-based disorders are both chemical, as in the case of medications, and electrical, as in the case of electrical or magnetic stimulation of the brain.
And these things are happening together. It sounds like from your description, the chemical reaction leads to the electrical impulses being transmitted.
Exactly. They go hand in glove.
Dr. Sturman, when we think of brain waves, which is perhaps the layperson's term for these electrical waves, what do we mean by things like brain waves? And what kind of different waves do we have?
That's also an excellent question. Just to elaborate a little bit on the previous question, the question was, how does information get to the brain and is processed by it? So there are receptors throughout the body, visual, auditory, cutaneous, that carry signals, again, electrochemical, through the peripheral and then central nervous system to the brain. And along the pathway to the final ending point of those signals, there are various way stations, an important one being a structure called the thalamus. The thalamus is sort of a triage system for sensory information and motor output in the brain. So it decides if it's a skin stimulation, it'll go one part of the brain. If it's a visual stimulation, it'll go to another part of the cortex. And then it's processed there, and a behavioral response is determined based on many, many things.
So the thalamus sounds a little bit like a traffic cop making decisions of where things should go.
And it's more than just a relay. It does actually make active decisions. It suppresses some things and facilitates others. But the brain waves, as you asked, are really epiphenomena. They're not a real thing. They're a result of the way the thalamus processes incoming electrical stimuli from the peripheral nervous system. So when the thalamus goes into a standby mode, which is what we call inhibitory, the firing of those neurons changes its pattern from a continuous firing pattern following the input to a what we call a burst silence pattern. And that bursting, which is an intrathalamic process, is projected up to the cortex and causes firing in the cortex to be burst-like. And if we record on the surface against some kind of reference, those bursts give us waves. So the waves are just an indication of the state of the thalamocortical networks. And that's why they're so useful, because they tell us whether the thalamus is processing that information in a standby mode or has really gone offline. And the different patterns we see are either no waves, which means it's processing, and waves that increase or decrease in frequency depending on the amount of attention involved, and then finally very, very slow waves when the system is offline. So we can use that information, the nature of the brain waves, as a code for determining the processing status of the brain.
So that these waves are not like, you know, the sound waves that my voice would make, but they are a record of something, but they are not the thing itself.
Well, your voice, which is a physical event, is actually making a rhythmic process that is picked up and amplified by the electronics of the sound system, and those rhythms are causing different frequencies and different modulations to give us your voice. But it's also an epiphenomenon of what's coming out of your mouth, actually, in the same sense.
I'm speaking to Dr. M. Barry Sterman. He's professor emeritus at the Department of Neurobiology and Biobehavioral Psychiatry at UCLA, and Dr. Sarah Lisenby, who is professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. Dr. Lisenby, what's the significance of, I've heard that there are different wave speeds, and what do those tell us?
Well, you're probably referring to the names of the oscillations within different frequency bands. So, for example, theta is a mid-range frequency oscillation around 5 cycles per second or 5 hertz. Delta, which is a slow frequency, less than, say, around 1 to 4 hertz, is something that is seen, for example, in deep sleep. Higher frequencies, like in the alpha, beta, or even gamma ranges, can be seen during wakefulness, and especially gamma oscillations can be seen during the performance of higher cognitive tasks. So the different frequencies have been thought to have different origins and to be associated with different aspects of brain function.
Now, Dr. Lisenby, the therapies that you use are things that introduce other kinds of electrical stimulation or other kinds of stimulation into the brain. How does that work, and what kinds of things do you use it for?
Well, let's start, for example, with transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. TMS refers to the non-invasive stimulation of the brain using rapidly alternating magnetic fields. And these magnetic fields induce small electrical currents in the brain. So basically, what we were talking about before, that electrical message that the brain uses to communicate, to induce action potentials, TMS can directly induce action potentials and change activity within these distributed networks. And TMS has been useful as a non-invasive brain mapping tool because, unlike brain imaging or EEG, which is electroencephalography, those are passive recorders that give you information about what the brain is doing. TMS, on the other hand, is an active stimulator, so it is actually changing brain activity. And because we can very precisely time when these very brief TMS pulses occur, this can allow us to control the temporal component of how we're interacting with the brain. So whereas when you give a medication, that medication is distributed in the bloodstream and it continues to act at synapses in a tonic or continuous fashion, TMS or other forms of electrical stimulation, which are pulsatile, these allow us to interact with the brain in a frequency-specific fashion, either to study brain-behavior relationships or possibly to treat them, although I'll point out the only condition that is currently approved by the Food and Drug Administration for therapeutic application of TMS is depression.
Now, say you were treating someone with depression, what would you do, and what would the patient actually feel with this kind of transcranial magnetic stimulation?
Well, the way it's performed, the subject is sitting in comfortably in a chair, is awake. There's no need for anesthesia. The TMS coil is placed on the head, and it's activated at a certain frequency. Our depression protocol is 10 hertz, so 10 pulses per second. This is given in brief trains, and these trains are repeated about twice a minute. The treatment session takes about half an hour, and we repeat that daily over a series of weeks. And what the person experiences is they feel a tapping on their head. This is because on the way to reach the brain, the magnetic field is stimulating the scalp muscles, so you feel this muscle contraction on your head. You also hear a clicking noise because you were talking about sound waves before. The TMS coil itself internally vibrates and that generates sound. But generally, it's been well tolerated with a very low, excellent side effect profile. And either high-frequency stimulation, say around 10 hertz or higher, to the left prefrontal cortex, and also low-frequency, say around 1 hertz, to the right prefrontal cortex, both of those stimulation paradigms have been reported to have antidepressant effects.
What do you and your colleagues think is causing this antidepressive effect? Do you have a sense of why this kind of treatment might work to help alleviate depression?
Well, in general, the high frequencies have been reported to have excitatory effects on cortical functioning, whereas the low frequencies have been reported to be inhibitory. And the general concept between high frequency on the left and low frequency on the right being beneficial in depression links to other research on abnormalities in functioning of the prefrontal cortex seen in people with depression, and also links to some hemispheric abnormalities between the right and left, suggesting that readjusting that right-left balance of activation may be therapeutic. Now, these are not hard and fast rules. The effects of TMS may differ depending on where in the brain you're stimulating and what the brain's doing at the time that it's being stimulated. But this is an active area of research using imaging and also physiology before and after TMS to try to get deeper into the mechanisms of action. But the active ingredient with TMS is electrical stimulation of the brain.
I'm speaking with Dr. Sarah Lisenby and also Dr. Barry Sturman for this week's Please Explain about various new treatments of the brain. And we're going to be taking your phone calls in a few minutes at, the phone number has gone off the screen, 212-433-9692. 212-433-9692. I will remember that for next time. And maybe some of these modalities could help me remember things, which would be a good thing. Dr. Sturman, the kinds of treatments that are done through neurofeedback, this is a different modality. Instead of stimulating the brain, is what you're doing sort of measuring the brain waves and working with a patient to learn how to modulate them, him or herself?
Yes. Let me just back up for a second and refer to some of the comments made by Dr. Lisenby. The early work on depression was EEG-based work, and it found that, in fact, if you saw activation on the right frontal, in the right frontal area, dorsal lateral frontal cortex, that was associated with negative thoughts, negative mood, bad behavior or bad thinking. And if it was activated on the left, it was more pleasant, positive activity. So people began looking at whether the EEG was right frontal activated or left frontal activated and associating that with mood and response to stimuli. And I think that was one of the guiding principles with the TMS transcranial work to activate the left hemisphere and attempt to deactivate the right frontal. But again, to respond to your question, We don't stimulate the cortex in the same manner that the transcranial work does. The attempt is to retrain circuitry in the brain, and we use the principle of operant conditioning, which goes way back to Thorndike, early educational psychologist who talked about the law of effect, that events that lead to positive reinforcement are increased in probability, and events that lead to negative reinforcement are decreased in probability. And that is became involved in the Skinnerian work. I'm sure most people are familiar with B.F. Skinner and his attempt to train rats and pigeons and
sort
even his
behavioral
daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's called operant conditioning, as opposed to the Pavlovian Russian school, which was classical conditioning. But it's the same thing. It's creating a circumstance where a stimulus and a response are brought together in time. And if the response is a positive, leads to a positive outcome, then the stimulus becomes an activation of that behavior. And that's called operant conditioning. What we do with EEG feedback is we first start out by mapping the brain, doing what we call quantitative EEG analysis to determine where abnormalities in the frequency patterns we were just talking about appear. For instance, in epilepsy, there's a certain kind of slowing and a spike in wave pattern. In brain injury, there's injury potentials and slowing also in the areas that were damaged. And we then use that information to attempt to change the pattern of the EEG vis-a-vis the frequency. And recent evidence, you know, all of this is far more complicated than we can discuss on the air here in a brief period of time, but we operate with general principles. So if we see an abnormal pattern and we provide reinforcement for producing the normal pattern or suppressing the abnormal pattern, we make assumptions about changes in the circuitry in the brain, and it is the networks, the circuitry, that is critical, not the individual neurons. And we actually, there is now evidence for what we call long-term potentiation, that is changes in synaptic behavior, as was mentioned earlier, that lead to prioritized circuits, and these improve the function of the brain in lots of different ways, both seizure disorders, attention issues, head injury problems, but it's a learning paradigm, and the subject is treated like an individual going to a gym, and it's going to be doing mind exercises, but they're guided by electrophysiology and current ability to convert that into information and feedback that they enjoy working with.
And I know the principal at my kid's school bought a kit that allowed kids to do a rudimentary form of neurofeedback, and it was a way of playing video games without using their hands, just with how they modulated their brain waves.
Right, and they really get a kick out of that.
Yeah.
Although the object is not to entertain them. It's really exercise, but at least you get them on board by making it fun.
And I'd just like to throw in there that that links to some of the underlying principles behind, say, the brain-machine interface, where it's not just a computer game that a child would get a kick out of, but it rather teaching someone who actually can't move a cursor because of paralysis to move that cursor by modulating oscillations in their brain could have a very important clinical impact.
Absolutely, and some people, I was involved in some of this too, some people have used that method to work with Lou Gehrig's disease patients who have no on-off signal available, but they can still change their brain waves, and it gives them a way of turning on the TV set or even making letters and communicating.
I'm speaking with Dr. Sarah Lisenby and Dr. Barry Sturman for this week's Please Explain about neurofeedback. We're going to have more, and we're going to be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 after a break. I'm speaking with Dr. Barry Sturman and Dr. Sarah Lisenby about various ways of treating our brains. And it's time now where we can take a couple of calls. I'm going to start with a listener who wrote in and wondered if any of the researchers that either of you have done are looking at various techniques to study or treat migraines in the modalities that you work with.
Sharon, you want to go first?
Well, I am familiar with a technology using weaker magnetic fields than standardly used with TMS for the treatment of migraines. I have not had personal experience with that, but I do understand that there have been some studies on that. I mean, the basic concept is if we could discover what is triggering the condition, mm-hmm. such as migraine or some other condition, and if it's amenable to spatially and temporally precise targeting with a non-invasively induced electric field, that might be helpful. But I don't personally have experience with the migraine treatment.
Dr. Sturman, have you had any experience with that?
Well, there's various publications in the neurofeedback literature that suggest that different applications of the concept have been effective with migraines. But the history of migraine is that unless you intervene before the actual headache has developed, you're unlikely to be able to affect it. I did, down the road, a long time ago, have one patient who had severe migraines, was a ranger working in the forest and would get terrible headaches when she was looking for forest fires. And I treated her as an epileptic, which was all I could do at the time. That is the same protocols we used with epilepsy. And she reported dramatic improvement. But certainly that was a single case situation, and there are probably alternative explanations to the outcome. But it was an interesting case.
Well, let's go to some listeners. We have a lot of people on the line. Tina from Brooklyn, we have you, and we would like to hear your question.
Yes, hello. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I myself have suffered from epileptic seizures ever since I had a severe head trauma when I was 30. I'm now 50. And, of course, I'd like to ask your wonderful men online a question how the general public relates out of their own ignorance to others with seizures. Right away, they get their own constant fear. After all, I didn't know anything about seizures before my head injury, and I would not face the fact that I had seizures. Right away, they think people who have seizures turn into very violent monsters.
Thank you.
As soon as you say seizures, you figure, oh, my gosh, she's going to go crazy. She's going to become physically violent. I was not told by the ambulance or the emergency room that I was going to have seizures.
Well, thank you so much for your question. Dr. Sturman and Dr. Lisenby, are the kinds of work that you do things that do treat seizures? I know, Dr. Sturman, you talked about epilepsy. Are other kinds of seizures receptive to this kind of treatment?
Yes, I've worked a lot in this field, and I appreciate what your caller is saying. There's really a bad education about seizure disorders in the general public, and there are many different kinds. Most seizures are minor events that people aren't even aware are occurring. What we usually think of, if we're uninformed about epilepsy, is a person falling down and going into tonic-clonic convulsions. But those are, by and large, well-regulated these days. They're much rarer unless there's a progressive brain disorder. But I certainly do have appreciation for her concern, and she shouldn't worry about that. In fact, worrying about it makes it worse. So the public, you do your best to explain to them that you're not a monster. It is well known that the seizure disorders, if they do cause active behaviors, they're non-directed, they're reflex-type behaviors, so there's nothing to be fearful of, and I would hope that she could get adequate treatment. If drugs don't work, try some of the alternatives.
Thank you.
I'd like to just add on that, from the brain stimulation field, there have been some studies with transcranial magnetic stimulation, especially using the lower frequencies, which have been reported to have inhibitory effects, trying to target the focus of the seizure and dampen down its activation. But we really need larger controlled trials to replicate that.
Well, thank you. I'm going to go to Julie from Roslyn. Julie, you had a question for the doctors.
I do. Thank you. I heard Dr. Sturman discussing operant conditioning, positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, and that such. And I can't help wondering about the implications for the treatment of autism, or if it's moving in that direction, is that possible? Are there any studies done?
Thank you.
Yes, there are studies. They're mainly small subject studies or single subject studies. My colleague, I have a good close colleague who has an autistic son, and he's working very diligently on this issue. There have been some findings that suggest some improvement. They're just as Dr. Lozandi said regarding seizures and transcranial stimulation. There have not been adequately controlled studies. And, of course, the problem with autism is we, in a sense, we don't know where to look. We don't really know what the brain is doing wrong that's causing that, although there's now some new findings regarding mirror neuron function not working right, that these people have certain circuits are disturbed so that they don't relate properly to behaviors that they observe. But there've been a couple of studies that suggest that might be a good direction, but it's still the jury.
You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about this. And Dr. Lizzie, this is something for you also. All of these illnesses that we're talking about, autism and depression, have such dramatic variance from person to person. Do you find when you do a treatment, you need to really tailor it to the particular individual that you're working with?
Well, you're raising a very good point about heterogeneity, and we do see that there's significant heterogeneity across individuals in terms of their symptom expression and possibly in the etiology that leads up to the disorder. And an important focus in the field has been to try to personalize the therapies to take that inter-individual variation into account. And I'm not sure that we're completely there yet, but we're trying to combine tools such as structural and functional imaging to better target the delivery of the brain stimulation technologies to take into account some of this variability. On the autism question that was brought up before, I just wanted to add that there is some new work at a very preliminary stage being done with imaging and transcranial magnetic stimulation to try to elucidate some of the neurocircuitry that may be disordered and underlying the core symptom clusters of autism, which include the social dysfunction, language dysfunction, and abnormal repetitive behaviors. And Alexandra Sporn at our group in Columbia Psychiatry is doing some of that work funded by Autism Speaks and the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation.
Hmm. I'm going to go now to Charles in Brooklyn. You had a question for the doctors.
Yes, I did. Thank you. I'm talking about peripheral neuropathy, which is a situation where you get a lot of pain, coldness in your feet, nerve tingling stops you from sleeping. Various neurologists have provided various ideas on this, from something called radio frequencing to Neurontin to painkillers. What do you do when this condition simply persists?
Dr. Lizzie, Dr. Sturman, do either of you have a thought on that?
Sure. So I'm a psychiatrist, not a neurologist, but my understanding is that in the field there are a number of approaches depending on what is the etiology of the peripheral neuropathy to begin with. There are some key vitamin deficiencies that can lead to this, which I would imagine you've been checked for, like B12 folate. There may be impingement of the descending nerve pathways that are causing a compression on those nerves that are causing the neuropathy, or other causes. And I understand that this can be very disturbing and disabling in terms of the sensations. And we also know that pain has a brain component as well, in addition to peripheral causes. But
Dr. Sturman, does neurofeedback address pain? Is that something that it's used for?
It has been used for pain. Again, no adequately controlled studies. And again, with reference to what we were saying earlier, there is, you know, it's a very complicated issue because it can be a structural influences in the spinal cord and the peripheral nervous system, or it can be a brain situation. Pain is one of the most complex sensory modalities there is. We still are trying to find out where it goes in the central nervous system, because most of the nerve fibers leave the fiber tracts before they even get to the cortex. But there is advancement occurring in that. And again, the job of the neurologist is to give the individual, the patient, some idea of what the etiology is, what is causing the pain, if they can determine that. And once knowing that, at least you have a starting point for trying to treat it. I think neurofeedback could be useful to the extent that some central nervous system inhibitory effect might be mobilized to shut the pain down. Because the pain, to the extent that it's consciously detected, is in the central nervous system.
Let's go to another call. This is Susan in Manhattan.
Hello.
Hello, yes, you're on the air.
These guests are so brilliant, and their work is so exciting. But I am a typical layperson concerned with my own problems, which has been depression for my entire adult life, with a recently discovered layer of ADHD. Now, what could I derive from their work that might possibly help me? Because as they're both doctors, they know that medication usually helps up to a certain point. I hear neurofeedback. Is biofeedback, which is very available, is that perhaps helpful? Or can they make any other suggestions? I know this is just, it's like asking somebody to diagnose you over the phone.
Well, but depression is something that many people suffer from. So I think this is a good question. I know it's something both of you have spoken about. And this will be our last question. What do each of your modalities have to offer to someone who might have depression?
So I'm happy to start. First of all, I think the take-home message is that there's hope. And don't give up. Seeing your psychiatrist or clinician for an evaluation to determine if all of the medication strategies have been tried. You know that there are multiple different classes of medications. Some may be effective when others are not. There are also augmentation strategies where you can combine medications together. And also combining medications with certain types of evidence-based psychotherapies can be very helpful. But in my clinical practice at Columbia Psychiatry, I really specialize in cases where the medications have failed. And
Dr. Lazambi, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'm realizing that we are running out of time. This has been such a fascinating subject to talk about. Thank you to all of the listeners, and thank you to Dr. Sarah Lazambi, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at Columbia University, and Dr. M. Barry Sturman, Professor Emeritus at the Department of Neurobiology and Biobehavioral Psychiatry at UCLA. Thank you to both of you. On Monday's show, guest host Jonathan Capehart speaks with journalist Sarah Chase about the Afghan election. Then our latest underappreciated summer reading series looks at Robert Musil's 3-volume novel, The Man Without Qualities. Also, a new documentary about 3 unaccompanied children who travel from Latin America to the U.S. border to reunite with their parents. Plus, a representative from the Union of Concerned Scientists explains why he thinks this is such a critical year to address climate change. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Drew Katchen and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein, in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week.